this is Tamiko Faison, your host of Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color who are leading and inspiring in their space. The purpose of this podcast is to inspire therapists, particularly therapists of color, by sharing the accomplishments of therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color who are leading in their space and to help support them in their roles. Today, our guest is Dr. Varlisha Gibbs, Scientific Programs Officer for the American OT Foundation, which is just one of her many roles. Dr. Gibbs has been an occupational therapist for 17 years. Leadership has always been an integral part of her career in academic preparation. She is a graduate of the University of Delaware and Columbia University's program in occupational therapy and has doctoral degrees, yes, I said degrees with an S, from Thomas Jefferson University and Seton Hall University. With a PhD in health sciences leadership from Seton Hall University's School of Health and Medical Sciences, her preparation ignited an interest in research within the field of occupational therapy. Dr. Gibbs has experience as a principal investigator, a research team member, and mentor, and has published peer-reviewed journals in addition to authoring two books. Dr. Gibbs is the inaugural chair of Delaware's first Master's of Occupational Therapy program at Wesley College. In that position, she mentors future practitioners, as well as faculty, new to higher education, and she is an entrepreneur. In 2003, Dr. Gibbs founded Universal Progressive Therapy Incorporated, a company that provides interdisciplinary and quality therapeutic services to families. As founding president, she provides treatment interventions and education in the areas of sensory integration, autism, as well as family-centered care. And let me just tell you, that is a brief bio. I don't know if I gave it justice. I hope it was accurate, Dr. Gibbs, because I read the links that you sent, and I just, the more I read, the more impressed I was. So I am, I know you have a lot of leadership roles. I didn't actually even know about the entrepreneurial pursuits that you have. And I clicked on that website and also heard you speaking on a YouTube video. And so I just wanted to add to that bio that you're also a dynamic speaker.
Oh, thank you.
as well. But welcome to the podcast. Welcome to our show. And again, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be with us. So I read your bio, but if you could just tell us about yourself in your own words and how you became interested in occupational therapy.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. And I will share that some of those roles are no longer active. And I can allude to that a little bit later and how they've kind of morphed into different aspects of my career right now. How did I get into occupational therapy is really, that is a long story. So I'll give you the abbreviated version. I was always interested in healthcare. And let me know if you want me to speak up or if I'm not clear. But I was always interested in healthcare and wanted to, along the way, be a pediatrician. And I have to be completely honest, I got to college and got into a bio class, and that was a rude awakening. So for me, I realized that that avenue probably wasn't going to happen, not at that time. I think I was, I was 17 when I entered into college, and I was fairly young and didn't quite understand what was required. And so it took me a while to really come around to what I wanted to do. I didn't declare a major until my junior year, which was just because I was required to do so. So I really didn't know what I was going to do. I ended up being a psychology major because I had an advisor that told me, you're doing really well in these psychology classes. I mean, you're getting A's and all of those. Why don't you just choose that? And I said, okay, sounds good to me. So, and, I had family and everyone's kind of like looking at me like, what is going on? Like, I always had an idea of what I was going to do. And then when I got to that stage of life, I think I was enjoying my time being a student and just thought that that would continue. And, I got to the point where, I had those sit down conversations, and one of my advisors said to me, I see that you're liking psychology. doing really well at that. I was also taking acting classes, which I enjoyed. I did well at that. I was really into writing, and I had all these different aspects of my personality, and actually started volunteering and then working at a physical therapy clinic on campus at the University of Delaware. And then I also started working off campus it's called the Back Clinic in Delaware. And my friend and I started working there for physical therapy. And my advisor sat me down and said, you know, it looks like you have all these interests, and one being the physical therapy part, but she wanted to introduce me to occupational therapy. And when she started telling me what it was, it really spoke to me, because I mean, it's very multifaceted in terms of a career. And it kind of fit all those quirky areas that I had. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a professional dancer, so I was really into movement and art, spirituality, and, you know, all those different things that comprise our OTPF, our framework, really kind of framed this career for me. And so I was a really late bloomer in terms of figuring out occupational therapy. I didn't know what it was. I like many, you know, during that time, I think we've definitely gained a lot more popularity now, you know, with people coming from undergraduate careers into OT. It's, you know, I used to be a chair of the program, as you mentioned, and we would get a plethora of applications. So now I feel like people are more aware. At that time, it wasn't that popular. And we still have a long way to go. We knew that as a profession. But at that time, I really didn't know much about it. But I figured out when my advisor was telling me to research it, and she told me a little bit about it, and she didn't know a whole lot herself, I realized that I actually had occupational therapy growing up. And did not know, you know, they said that this consultant was going to come see me. I had horrible handwriting, and I went to a private Catholic school, a little school down the street from my home, and they really were concerned about my sloppy handwriting. So I had this person that would come in once a month, and eventually she said she doesn't need me. She can write neatly if she likes to, but I was often moving very quickly through things. So, and then I had I'll make it short. So I have a little condition. It's a rare lymphocytosis. It's a condition that I was born with. And I, at one point, was hospitalized for some issues that I was having with my legs. And I had an individual come to my room that would take me to what I thought was a playroom at the hospital, and had me do, you know, some hands-on activities and things I normally would do at home. And she was an occupational therapist. So along the way, ended up working with a rheumatologist, you know, personally receiving rheumatology at a hospital in Delaware. And that physician allowed me to, you know, meet up with the therapist there to do shadowing. And that's when I realized, from working with her, all the experiences I personally had with OT. And that's that kind of sealed the deal. And I was able to, when I did shadowing hours, I was able to actually work with a young lady who had a TBI from a car accident, who was a dancer. And I was able to help her do some dance moves. I was able to help the therapist there show him some positions for dance, for ballet, and had him work with her to do ballet during her therapy session, just a few moves. And the mom started crying during that time. And that was like, okay, this is it. I think I finally figured it out.
Wow, that is so cool. So you fell in love with, you had those reflections of the actual OT experiences that you had growing up, and you knew that this is what you wanted to do. So how did you go from, you know, being an OT to becoming a leader? And let's talk about your leadership roles and your entrepreneurial endeavors.
Well, one of my former students said it nicely. He said, you know, you're kind of like this quiet storm. So what do you mean by that? He's like, you know, you had this calm demeanor, but you're like a force to be reckoned with. And I said, wow, I never thought about it like that. You know, I tend to go into things willing to learn what I can and to be a team player. And somehow I always end up taking some sort of leadership role. And so that's the same thing with OT for me. I got into OT school. I went to Columbia, and going to Columbia University in New York City was a culture shock for me. And during that time frame, you know, going into the program, I really wanted to be open and I didn't know a lot about the city and I was nervous. But soon after, I realized when, you know, they were doing the class elections that, that's something I want to be interested in, you know, running. And I end up, you know, myself and another individual, they voted as co-class president. So from the start of my OT career, you know, I led my class, and we actually during that time frame experienced 9/11. So we had a lot more, and we were in New York, and so there was a lot more concerning, you know, social aspects of that role that I wasn't expecting, that my classmates weren't expecting. So, you know, we did have a lot of initiatives around that. And from that point, when I entered as a licensed, you know, occupational therapist and passed my boards and got my first position, I wanted to kind of, you know, true to myself, did not know exactly what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I knew I loved pediatrics, but I also enjoyed working with the older adults as well. You know, so I ended up doing really working in agencies, doing per diem work to start because I wanted to get a little more experience in acute care, outpatient, early intervention. And so I was pretty much all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I ended up at some point landing at Kessler, one of their satellite locations for at a SNF, which I think was really good for me as a, you know, up and coming therapist. And I would get up super early to come in and work with my clients to get them ready for the day. And I would leave late to make sure that they were, you know, getting, doing mealtime and, you know, getting them back into bed. And after my director decided to open up his own practice, he said to me, you know, I think that you should take this role. And I was only a few years out of school. And so that was, you know, I wasn't sure if that was something I wanted to do, but I ended up doing that. And eventually I kind of followed his lead and I opened up my own business. So you mentioned, you know, Universal Progressive Therapy, and that business for me was more of, it was things I was seeing in the field that I wanted to be done differently. And it wasn't so much of me wanting to be a business owner versus wanting to do things right, wanting to give clients the time that they deserved, quality care. Mm-hmm. I was in Northern New Jersey at that time, and there were a lot of agencies and, you know, non-OTs running agencies and mm-hmm. clinics. And I really felt like some of the things that I saw from there in New York City, I mean, I worked at some places where I would come in and they would say, pick a kid. And I would say, excuse me, pick a kid, go ahead and work with them without a treatment plan, without goals, without, you know, assessments. And so I wanted to change that, at least for me. You know, I didn't want to be part of that. You know, I felt like it was unethical practice in some capacity. So I ended up starting my own early intervention agency, and then from there having contracts with certain skilled nursing facilities, and then eventually hiring staff, and then opening up a facility myself where we did off-site, you know, clinic-based, I would say community-based practice, because a lot of the work that we did was with parents and caregivers, and I would spend a lot more time not just with the individual, with the client, but with their family and caregivers as well. And I found myself really working with, like I did, I gave you my story about shadowing. Mm-hmm. And so I had, of course, you know, you will always get students that are trying to get into the graduate program that want to come shadow. I had some work for us, you know, as aides in the clinic. And I really enjoyed teaching them. They challenged me in a way that made me go back to my books, that made me go back to evidence-based practice. I mean, and that wasn't a phrase that we were using back then. You know, it, I feel like it probably was taught, but it wasn't as trendy, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, as it is now, you hear EBP and everyone knows what you're talking about. And I didn't at that time. So the students were the ones that kind of pushed me like to, okay, if you're using this in practice, you need to know why, you know, and go back to the evidence. And so that's what pushed me to go back to school. I was getting my PhD in health sciences, and then I got married, I had babies. And mm-hmm. so at that time I had an instructor say to me, you know, I know you're in this program, but how come you haven't explored the doctorate of occupational therapy? And I said, because there isn't such a thing. And I didn't know that they actually had that, that they started developing OTD programs. And so that was a shocker to me. Having my own business, I was doing a lot of work in the PhD program with non-OTs. And so I didn't have a lot of time where I had conversations with fellow OTs to pick their brain, you know, on intervention strategies or, you know, to kind of have powwows as you would, you know, if I were working with the team. So I decided to go to get my OTD. I wanted to really kind of go back to the roots of OT. I felt like I was losing it a bit. I was feeling very much like, you know, I was doing movement science at that time, and I felt like I was doing a lot of physical therapy work. And I, my classmates were PTs, they were pharmacists and nurses, which was great for interprofessionalism, but the OT piece was lacking for me. And so I left to get my OTD and eventually went back for my PhD, which was a little bit crazy to my husband. He's like, are you kidding me? Yeah, I promised him I wasn't going to do that. But, you know, you get on that 10-year mark where you're going to lose credits. And I said, okay, either I do it or I'm going to lose all that time I put in. And I actually had left my practice to be an assistant professor. And, you know, once you get into academia, that is something that is encouraged, you know, if you can, to go ahead and get that PhD or, you know, EdD, a certain level of a doctorate that will allow you to do research and to be able to eventually mentor. And kind of the trend in my history after taking on an assistant professor position, there were changes in the department. We at that time had one of the first entry level doctorate programs, so I had to assist with that accreditation process. I ended up being at some point the director of their doctoral capstone projects. And when leadership changed, I ended up being the director of the doctoral program. And so from there, I did some leadership roles and eventually took the position at Wesley College in Delaware to start the program. And for me, that was full circle because I was from Delaware and they hadn't had an occupational therapy program. And so I decided to, you know, for me, I was happy. I had faculty members and peers that I enjoyed working with. And so I really wasn't looking to exit. But when I was told about that position, I did a speaking engagement for Delaware Occupational Therapy Association. And when I was told about it, I was really intrigued and wanted to help them. I didn't know I was going to end up being the director and chair of that program. And that's kind of how it happened. And along the way, being from assistant professor to associate tenured professor, I've always helped and mentored individuals with their research, with their scholarly activities for promotion. And as well as our students, we've done grant projects where the students were really hands-on in terms of that lab work and collecting data, recruitment, all of that. And so when this position had opened, I was already in that role in Delaware and I wasn't looking to move. But it was, I believe, a couple years later where I was still hearing about the position. And Wesley had gotten full accreditation. Our students had graduated, had 100% pass rate on their boards. And I felt like it may be an opportunity for me to allow others a leadership role there, you know, to step up and give them a chance to move myself out of the way and go on to my next role, which is here as a scientific programs officer.
Wow, this is so impressive. So I'm curious, as you're speaking about this journey of really going in as just to serve and then ending up in leadership positions as you go in to serve and being okay with having someone else to come in after you've gotten, you feel like it's time for you to move into another role. What kind of training do you feel like you've had to help you in these roles? So you just decide, okay, I'm going to start this business. and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be the director of this program. I'm going to start this program. What kind of training did you have to go into these roles?
Life, I think. I think for me, it was more of whenever there was an opportunity to, to do something outside of the requirements, I always took it. So for instance, for our master's program in occupational therapy at Columbia, we had to choose between two classes as an elective. And I can't remember the other one, but the one I chose was on entrepreneurship. And I was really intrigued by the individual that was our adjunct instructor for that class. And it was more of a seminar type class, and her stories and how she was able to get to that position where she could open up her own business really spoke to me. I always been somewhat unique in terms of how I operate. And so having that ability to create was something I was intrigued by. I then decided to actually take an additional field work outside of what was required. So I took a field work working at a outpatient pediatric clinic. And this individual that was the owner, he actually became a mentor of mine at that time, Jason Campbell. He's in New Jersey. And he was really good about pushing me outside of my comfort zone. I was pretty passive at that time. Again, just wanting to take in all of anything I could, learn everything. And he was the one that taught me to, well, don't ask a question, you know, that you don't want the answer to, you know, working with the kids, you know, I would say, do you want to play? And they would say no. So he really taught me how to step outside of that quiet, you know, passive personality I had, which wasn't really me. It was just me wanting to kind of be, you know, I was a little anxious and just take everything in. So I, again, working with him, I had that direct mentorship to see how you would do, you know, day-to-day operations, what it was like to be a business owner. And so I think those experiences really taught me a lot. So it wasn't so much like direct training, but more of those direct experiences from others that have done, you know, those things. And I knew eventually that I probably would be wanting to do something on my own. Again, I didn't know it was going to be that early in my career.
Was your professor Iris Kimberg by chance at Columbia?
Iris, is that what you said?
Iris, yes.
Yes, yeah.
So she's actually a consultant that I've used as an entrepreneur for years.
And oh my gosh.
Absolutely fabulous. So when you said that, I was thinking, wow, I wonder if it was Iris. And I think I'm so glad you said that, because I think it's so important to have courses in entrepreneurship. And I think some programs have it and others don't. But as you mentioned earlier in the interview, when you said that, you know, you've seen these practices being ran by non-OTs, and not all of them, but I've heard too many stories about those practices and the ethical issues and dilemmas that therapists have to deal with. And I really would just love to see more programs have coursework on entrepreneurship for those who do want to pursue it.
Yes, yes. Wow, that's small world.
Isn't it? I'll have to email her after the interview, let her know that she's got a shout out on this podcast.
Yeah.
So in terms of, so that's your mentor for entrepreneurship. What about the leadership roles in academia, and any particular mentors or training that you felt helped prepare you for those roles?
Well, I think there were some events that, you know, occurred during those time frames where we had a significant change in faculty, people moving on to different positions. And I was almost thrown into that in a way, in terms of, well, you know, if I don't have the person that was here that previously taught the course, I need to be able to figure this out myself. And so with that experience, I found myself helping others that were then coming in, you know. That's just in my nature. I think it's in most of our natures, right? As occupational therapists, that's what we do. And so as new faculty members were coming in, even if I hadn't been there all that long, I was willing to share whatever it was that I had learned. And, you know, I was always a sponge. You know, I had, we had one faculty meeting, and I would kind of wait to the end to give my two cents. And someone said, you know, you sit through the whole meeting quiet, but then you say something profound at the end, you know, but it's because I take it all in and then I analyze it. And so from doing that, I think my peers began to respect my opinion. I did work with my chair that hired me at that time. as well as I had the co-chair and some seasoned faculty members that really took me under their wing and were willing to show me everything, you know. And if there was a grant that they were working on, but they wanted to step down at that time for whatever reason, they would say, I think Farleisha would be a good candidate for it. So they were kind of pushing me in that direction as well. And I think it was more in terms of the leadership and stepping up was, okay, when there was a need, you know, people took other faculty positions or retired. Now we have these gaps. Even if we're trying to hire, who's going to fill that gap in an interim? And so I was always willing to step up and do that. And I think it was more of my peers. I remember one day they sat me down and they were like, you know, there was a specific role and opportunity. And they said, I think that you are the person for it. And they really surprised me when they said that. Talking about them, just fine teaching these classes, just fine advising these students. And they're like, no, we think you can do it. So I think it's, I have to be grateful for the people that I've worked with along the way that have kind of pushed me into the leadership role.
That's great. So they saw and probably continue to see your potential. And I'm glad that you are willing to step up in those roles. Mm-hmm. So our occupational therapy profession has 4 to 6% persons of color. Mm-hmm. How has that fact impacted your entrepreneurial leadership roles, if at all? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I certainly can. For me, and I think this has been a topic of the profession for years, right? And right. I would say, you know, going into being a program director, we have leadership meetings that I would attend. And I feel like at every meeting, there would be an effort to talk about this and the diversity or lack thereof, of diversity and inclusion in the profession. And even now in this role, that is a conversation we have in regards to researchers, you know, having doctorally prepared researchers that are, you know, of color, of different diversity of different walks of life in general, because we know that our profession, you know, the look of our profession, the face of our profession has not changed since it started. And that's a fact, you know, that there are statistics that they typically would share at those meetings that are just very eye-opening. And so for me, I can speak to the fact that one of the driving forces for me to leave the program that I started, that again, I was happy at and enjoying and loving being with the students, one of the big pushes for me to take this role was to show our profession, to have a leadership role that others like myself could see and say, oh, well, maybe something I could do. Maybe I can become an occupational therapist, or maybe I could actually step into leadership. Maybe I should look into volunteer opportunities with, you know, the foundation or association to be able to get myself out there a little bit. And it was actually, you know, one of my, Paula Kramer was one of my former chairs, you know, back in the beginning of my career. And I remember we were at a conference and she said to me, she introduced me to one of her mentors from when she first started out. And she was part of, you know, the Black Caucus, the National Black Caucus of Occupational Therapists. And at that, during that time, I think she was heading to a meeting at conference, and I decided to go. And I saw, you know, from that meeting that there were a lot more of us than I thought, you know, and that there were wonderful leaders and people that have done great things along the way, and I just wasn't aware of it. I wasn't even aware. And Paula Kramer herself is not, you know, she's not African American, but she was the one to push me to get involved. She said, you know, you really should go talk with her and maybe go attend the meetings and see what they're doing. And so from that, I'm like, gosh, I see how we can really impact each other, you know, by looking at those practitioners. I was really in awe. And so when this position opened, I decided that it was for me, first of all, of course, it has to be in alignment with my career goals and my skill set. And when I did that, I said, you know, one of the main reasons why I would leave and move my whole family would be because I know that there will be other young ladies and young men that could see someone like myself and look up to them. And when I did take this role, I saw emails coming in, stories from individuals that I never met, you know, just in all of the comments about thank you for doing this, thank you for, you know, putting yourself out there to be a leader and showing our profession, you know, someone of color that's able to lead. And, you know, for them, I had one lady say that she was inspired to continue on to get her doctorate degree because she saw what I was doing. So that for me was a huge driving factor, and still is. You know, I try as much as I can to reach out to participate in events or mentoring other individuals. Now, from some of our events, I've had young ladies ask if they can continue working with me, and I continue to do that.
Wow, that is so inspiring. And as I said, before we even started this interview, I've been inspired just by watching you on the social media platforms. So again, thank you for your leadership in our profession.
Thank you.
So what advice would you give to therapists of color who are seeking to go into entrepreneurial or leadership roles, who are a little reluctant because of the diversity in our profession?
I would say, I mean, I think the running theme here as I'm talking out loud and listening to myself is mentorship, you know. I think even sometimes you have a mentor, you don't realize you're a mentor. You know, looking back, I'm like, okay, that person definitely mentored me, and so did she, and so did he, you know. So I think it's really finding that person that can be a mentor. And they may not be an occupational therapist. You know, they may be a business owner. They could be a leader in other capacities. There's been so many individuals that I've worked with along the way that I could say definitely provided mentorship for me, that allowed me to feel more comfortable to be able to do that. You know, for some of us, you know, how I was raised, definitely my mother and grandfather who were, you know, and my grandmother who were all really on top of me to work harder, to do a little bit more. I'll spare you some of the phrases I used to hear growing up, but I'm sure you can relate. You know, I had to do a little bit more. And that push from the beginning was always there. And then once I exited and was on my own, I found other people to fulfill that role, to continue to push me to do a little bit more. So sometimes you need those people. You need those cheerleaders. You need those people to tell you, okay, yeah, no, you're not going to be able to start your business this year because you don't know how to do A, B, and C. You know, you need someone that's going to give you those hard conversations and challenge you. And for me, it was always, if you tell me no, I'm going to go do it. So if you tell me no, that means I'm going to really figure out how it's supposed to be done, and I'm going to prove you wrong. So I always needed that push. I had a advisor tell me in college, because I told you I was kind of having enjoying my time as a college student for a while. And I had one advisor. He was part of the science program for minorities that they had there. And he sat me down and he said, yeah, you know, if you want to go to grad school, I think you're going to have to look at the Midwest with these grades. The only way that you could possibly get to into an East Coast program would be if you get straight A's this semester. And I said, really? He said, yeah, your GPA is too low. You're going to need to get straight A's. And guess what I did? I got straight A's that semester. So for me, even though he wasn't my favorite person, he was a mentor for me at that time because he pushed me to go a little bit further. And so I think, you know, that's key. You need someone that knows, and having not just one, but multiple mentors, you know, because I have, even peer mentors. I have a friend that she has her own business. She still has it. And she's a physical therapist. We volunteered together, you know, and worked together at PT clinics back in college. And so we would bounce things off of each other when we both had our own businesses, you know, sharing experiences of, what not to do, learning from our lessons, and being able to talk to each other about, okay, I didn't know about this mandate. I didn't know about this, you know, insurance clause, you know, and sharing that with each other. So finding a peer that also has a business doing something similar. And like I said, she was PT and I was OT, but we were able to share stories with each other. And so some of the hard lessons that I learned, I was able to tell her, and vice versa.
Yeah, that you make such a good point there, because you really don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, so I say that all the time. Yeah. And it is so important to have mentors, coaches, consultants, peers, you know, just other people to, like you said, bounce ideas off of and to help guide you. So sounds like you have those in your roles, but you also serve in that role for other people as well.
Yeah. So,
and you're up for challenges. Sounds like you like a challenge. So
I guess I do.
So what's next for you? What are your do you have other professional goals?
Yeah, you know, I was recently asked that I did a interview for some students, and they asked me what was my, you know, next steps, 5 years, 10 years. So you've kind of caught me at a precocious stage where they got me thinking, and now I'm like, wow, I need to give this more thought, more time, you know, transitioning into this position and being so focused on the now, I haven't given it much thought. I guess in general, I want to be able to continue to impact our field. I've been continuing to do volunteer work. I continue to work with the Commission on Practice. Right now, we're finalizing the framework, you know, OTPF4 for the profession. So I want to continue doing those type of efforts. I have another, you know, business venture, which is not like the previous one. I do a lot of pro bono work where I would sit around the table for individuals, for instance, parents that don't quite understand IEPs. Mm-hmm. And being an advocate for them, being an advocate for them in regards to what to say during the meeting, what paperwork needs to be done. I mean, you'll be surprised at the steps that aren't taken that are supposed to be taken when people, you know, don't know. I mean, they don't know what they don't know, right? Like as you said. So that's been something moving forward, I would like to do more advocacy as an individual here at the foundation. That's not part of my role, but, you know, as a professional, I want to be able to impact a little bit more and be able to have my kids to do that. You know, I was talking to a neighbor and I said, since we relocated, you know, we haven't done as much as we used to do. So we want to get back into that capacity. But yeah, I mean, I want to continue being a leader. I don't know exactly what that means right now. So I think once I'm at that stage of life, I'll say I'm past 40. And so there's a lot of thoughts in my head right now about what's next. Where do I go? I'm not sure.
Well, I have no doubt that you will continue to lead. So you have, you know, in addition to these, the roles as the volunteer and the scientific programs officer for the American OT Foundation, you're a wife and a mom. How do you stay organized? Because I share some of these roles with you, and I'm asking for personal advice. I'm also asking for others who may be balancing
similar roles. You know, I think the first thing is to not cast judgment against yourself. You know, and I don't know if my husband would agree with this, but if the dishes aren't done, so what? You know, so.
Amen to that one.
Yeah, you know, I don't cast judgment. I used to have so much guilt about certain things, little things, you know, as a mom or even as a friend. I mean, I'm at the stage of life, if someone has an event, that's great. But if I really just want some time to be with my family or be home, I say I can't attend. And I don't give a lie or an excuse, you know, and say, thank you for the invitation, you know, hope you have a great event, hope you have a great birthday, I may send a gift, you know. Mm-hmm. So you give yourself that time without guilt, without judgment. You have to. And for me, I think whatever personal, you have to have some sort of, let's call it ritual, whatever it is. It could be, you could be religious, you could be spiritual, whatever you call it. You know, everyone has their own thing. You have to be able to have a practice to keep you sane each day. You know, mine is meditation, and I sit quietly every morning and every evening. And if I'm busy or if I'm traveling, that could be in a car, it could be on a flight, you know, but making sure that I do that twice a day is necessary for me. And so I think when you do that, it allows you to be open and to be receptive to, you know, opportunities you may encounter that day. Just having better self-regulation. And because when you don't, and when you're working in an anxious state, that's when things go wrong. You know, that's when you make mistakes. That's when you're frustrated. You may start yelling at your kids when you don't want to. You know, so finding a way to, you know, be quiet with yourself you know, during portions of your day. And I will tell you that as much as I don't like my kids on electronics, the cell phones are the best thing for a parent. There's a thing called an alert that will alert you when you have to do something. So I live by that. And if I don't put it on my Outlook calendar, it may not happen. So, and I think, you know, a lot of times people don't realize those basic things that are available to them, because maybe you never worked in an office setting or as faculty, and you don't realize, like, gosh, I could actually, you know, send a request on my calendar to someone to just have a phone call, or if I'm supposed to, you know, meet up with someone, and I could put that alert in there and it'll remind me, you know, that I had this coming up. So there's so many different things you could use with, you know, the electronic to help you stay organized. I mean, that's how I operate. Some people still like to write things down. If I write it down, that it's great, but I may not even look at it. So I need to have it in my phone.
So you're using your electronics to your advantage, and you've made self-care through meditation a priority. Mm-hmm. What other occupations do you enjoy?
Well, believe it or not, along the way, I think I might have mentioned, I don't know, but I was a professional dancer. So yes. I danced from the age of 2 on, and I was in several dance companies even while in college. And in grad school, I was in a dance company as well that obviously had to stop at a certain point because it was just way too much. But I don't get to do that as much as I used to. But whenever I can, I mean, I love to dance. So that is certainly, you know, it's the occupation for me, is being able to do that. Not so much now since we moved, but I was a caregiver. My grandmother lived with us after her, my grandfather passed, as well as my mother, who was caring for her. So she was living with us. So she lived with us for a period of time and had, you know, a lot of healthcare needs. So I also, you know, still having that role, if there's something that occurs and if I can get on the phone with her OT, because she receives OT services, and or with the doctors, I still do that, and I'm able to pull from that perspective. There's nothing like being a caregiver versus, you know, reading it, you know, in our documentation. Mm-hmm. We write about it, and caregiver training and discharge planning, it is nothing like living it, you know. So now I have that experience to pull from as well. But I would say that those are, you know, and the priority, of course, is being the mother and the wife, or the occupations that I have. And then, you know, for me, spirituality is a big piece of it. As I mentioned, the meditation, and, you know, that's several conversations I have with my friends about that. That's something that I really love to do as a pastime. And, you know, it's almost like leisure for me in addition to spirituality. So and reading certain books around that, you know. And I've never been a big reader. And to be honest, I will do audiobooks if I can. I will. I'm a little, you know, because I have to do so much. I've always had to do so much reading for school or for work, that if I could just listen to something, sometimes I'll choose to do that. And right now I have a few friends that were, you know, doing a book club, Children of Blood and Bones. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I read that book. And then now the second edition has come out, and we're reading that. And, you know, I think it'll take us all longer than we think, because we're all busy and most of us are parents, but we have a goal to meet up and talk about the book. So
that's great. That's great. Now, how can we support you in your current and future roles and endeavors?
Oh, well, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I think for me, when, you know, in this role, I've received so much support already. I think just having that continue, you know, people you know, acknowledging or the work that's being done, you know, liking a post or retweeting, you know, if there's an event or something going on. We just did one in Chicago, and I felt like there was just a lot of support around that. Even if people couldn't attend, they were posting on their social media. And so those things are very helpful, even if it doesn't seem to be, but it really is. And, you know, just, I would say, be a mentor, you know. You know, for me, that would, it's not directly impacting me, but I think just mentoring other people and pulling them up, you know, as you're climbing the ladder, reaching back is something that I will suggest and ask others to do.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. I mean, from the beginning of this interview all the way to the end, it's still about serving and giving back, which is why I think you're so successful in your roles.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, what you put out is what you get back, right?
It's so true. So true. Anything else that you would like the audience to know? Any last words of wisdom or that you'd like to leave with us?
I would just say right now we're, you know, at a stage of change within the profession, you know, the way that billing is working and reimbursement. And one of the things I do have to prioritize as a scientific programs officer is research, is evidence. So, and just encouraging clinicians to, if you're interested in research, you know, find an institution near you that, that they're doing research in OT where you can even just, you know, be a data collector, you know, part of the research team. It doesn't always have to be something that is really far-fetched from your wheelhouse, but we just need more research. If you're interested in getting into research, look into those programs, you know, doctoral programs, PhD programs, doctor of science, you know, whatever would fit your lifestyle. But I think, you know, we are afraid of that. You know, I'm looking at a timeline for getting a doctorate, a PhD. For me, I remember it was daunting, and I was thinking, wow, I think it was, at the time, it was like, oh, 2004? That's so long from now. And now we're in 2020 almost. So it's not, it goes by quicker than you would think, you know. But if you're really itching and you're contemplating it, look into it and talk to other people that have gone through programs of interest. And even, you know, if you're interested in an OTD and being an, you know, really expert clinician, and working, well, maybe you're working under a researcher, a PhD, but in clinical research to be part of their team, you know, I encourage that. So I would say that that is something that I want us to think about. I want, we're doing a conference at the AOTA conference in Boston. We're going to be doing a session on looking at enhancing research in occupational therapy, enhancing evidence, because we know that evidence is what our clinicians need to be able to utilize. And we're going to be talking about how, what other training opportunities are there in relationship to becoming a researcher. And we're working along with, you know, the National Black Caucus as for OT. And we also have panel members from COTAD that are going to be talking about diversity and inclusion and a research career. And so, you know, that, you know, I encourage those that are coming to conference to consider attending that event, as well as our other foundation events. We have a wonderful breakfast with a scholar, and during the breakfast with the scholar, that event will be with Dr. BJ Miller, and he has a wonderful story. And he actually, I believe he's a triple amputee and a doctor that works with hospice and hospice. And so he's an author. He's been on Oprah Super Soul Sunday. If you're like me, I love Oprah. So I've seen him. And so just the fact that he's met Oprah, I'm excited. So I just encourage everyone to look at our website, AOTF.org. That's AOTF.org. And we have some events that we'll be having at conference, and I would be excited to, you know, meet some of you there.
That's great. I'll include those links as well as your social media platforms in the summary for this podcast. And I know we're wrapping up, but I do want to point out how important you said it is for us to have data. And I've just recently been in some discussions about Facebook groups about the value-based care system and how that's impacting the profession. it's like maybe like a year ago, I was having conversations and people were so excited about it. And they said, oh, this is a great time for OT to show our value because we have such great economic value and we, you know, have these proven outcomes. And then all of a sudden it's here and I'm hearing stories about OTs being laid off.
Yes.
And it's just the reverse. And like you said, we need the data to prove our economic value.
Exactly. Yeah. And we need to also be realistic and be willing to look at emerging practice settings. Or I should say some of them aren't really emerging anymore, but non-traditional settings. Yes. We have to be willing to do so. Case management jobs. And, you know, there are certain positions I'm sure we've all encountered where like, I can do that. You know, my training as an OT, I can certainly do that. Why do they only list social work and nursing? We can definitely do it. So, you know, looking at those opportunities to expand OT.
I agree 100%. Thank you so much, Dr. Gibbs.
Welcome.
I really enjoyed our conversation. Hope that we can continue to have more in the future. And please support her work at the American OT Foundation and check out the links that will be in this summary of this podcast. That is our show for today. Don't forget to subscribe and tell others about this podcast. As always, I was so inspired. Until next time, thanks for listening.